What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar. This morning, I'm joined by Deputy Editor Billy Steele. Hey, Billy.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Billy is here to talk about the best gadgets we've seen in 2025. He did the hard work of compiling a choice selection from all of Engadget's writers. So we've got a big feature about that on the site. We'll dive into some of the highlights from that. There's also some news and stuff to dive into, as always. Also joining us is producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
I'm not going to talk all that much, hopefully, because my mic sucks. I'm annoyed about this. Like, yeah. Go watch the stream for the reason. It's silly.
For the reason.
I forgot a cable.
Well, Ben, it's like going to, I don't know what the equivalent is, but you're going to the party. You're going to the podcast party, a podcast conference, and Ben does not have the right cable for his microphone.
Somebody will have the right cable. It's just that nobody is here yet. Like, people arrive today.
Also, death to micro USB, that thing sucks. Those cables suck. Those connectors bend all the time. So Ben has the Shure MV7, which I also walk around with, and that thing is a pain to keep like a good cable for it. So anyway, as always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and really any podcasting service. That's helpful. And drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Join us Thursday mornings, typically around 10:30 a.m. Eastern, when we do a live stream, so you can see us in action. Sometimes we're showing off gadgets. At least you'll see our pretty faces, and we'll do some audience Q&A as well. So tune in for that. Let's get right to it. Engadget's Best of 2025, which I think actually came a little early this year, right, Billy? But we kind of had to get this done because of many reasons, but also we have to deal with CES planning and so much stuff. This is a good time, though. The end of October to take a look back. There's really not many things we'll be reviewing for the next couple of months. How did this all come about for you, Billy? And any surprises for you from collecting our best devices of 2025?
So yeah, to speak to your first point about timing, you're exactly right. We have CES planning coming up. Lots of briefings ahead of time that start, you know, this month, even though CES is 2 months away. We also have a lot of other year-end content coming. Winners and Losers is a popular one that we do every year, as well as a number of other things that we are working on. So wanted to get this one out first. So basically what we did was we compiled the best of 2025 based solely on review scores. So this wasn't like a editor's vote, you know, sort of subjective thing where we were just picking and making choices. This was based solely on the highest rated products that we reviewed from the year in each category. Most of them, except for a few exceptions, earned a score of 90 or above. So they were editor's choice. We did have a few high 80s that we felt were notable products who were the highest rated in their respective categories that we included as well. And for the curious, the two highest rated products, there was a tie for the highest rated products. Both of them earned a score of 94, and that was the Sony 1000X M6 headphones and the Google Pixel 10 Pro and Pro XL.
Nice. Very nice. Any major surprises? Because I feel like there's going to be an iPhone there. There's going to be a Google Pixel, most likely, and other Apple devices. Anything that kind of came out of left field for you?
Yeah. So to speak to the Pixel phone and Apple situation, those products are so different and have such different audiences that we felt like there had to be an Android representative, but also an iPhone representative. And there are so many new iPhones that come out every year that, you know, it's a competition amongst themselves, sort of, in that category. So we did have a best phone overall, which was the Pixel 10 Pro. And then we did select a best iPhone from Apple's stable of products as well. And if you're curious,
you'd have a comment war. Yeah.
Billy, I feel like I need to be the voice of the internet commentariat here and say, like, saying that there's an entire category for best iPhone feels like a participation trophy. Like, Apple needs to be represented when otherwise you could just say, here's our best overall phone, and also the iPhone 17 Pro is really good. What would you have to say about that?
I would say there was a lot of discussion about this, and for the sake of not still being in those discussions to this day, this is sort of how we settled on how we were going to do it. There is a dedicated foldable phone category, which feels like a little bit more of a differentiator than, you know, overall phone or whatever. That's still a blossoming category to an extent. So, yeah, I mean, I hear the arguments about, you know, whether or not that's a participation trophy or not. And all I can say is, you know, those arguments are valid.
It's I feel like if we had just called it like best Android phone and then best iPhone, that's really all you're dealing with right here, right? It's going to be some sort of Android phone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get it. I totally get it. I'm going to quickly go down the list here because it's a lot of stuff we expect. Best laptop, MacBook Air, M4. Best Windows laptop, the Dell 14 Premium. We really have not heard much buzz about that. Dell rebadged their XPS line to Dell Premium. I feel like the buzz around them has kind of dissipated, but we still like the Dell 14 Premium. Best smartwatch, Apple Watch Series 11. Best tablet, Apple iPad Air M3. Best desktop, Apple Mac Studio M4 Max. That kind of makes sense. Gaming handheld, Nintendo Switch 2.
That's also the most developed one of the bunch.
Yeah, I mean, if you're including like the PC gaming handheld things, I guess like it's a big category. It's a wild and exciting category right now. I'm just going to keep going real quick. The Sony 1000XM6, which I've not touched, but I really like the XM5s. AirPods Pro 3 for best earbuds. Best CPU, which I feel like is just in there too. We don't really do many CPU reviews, but I got to review the AMD Ryzen 9 9950X3D this year, and that thing is a beast. That thing is a beast. It's also powering this live stream. And it's a 16-core thing, 3D V-cache. It is kind of cool that we had some time to review a CPU this year. Best GPU, the GeForce RTX 57 Ti. Best drone, DJI Mavic 4 Pro. Best camera, Sony AF11. I have not heard much. A112.
I mean, it's who can keep up with the Sony model
names? I hate their names. I hate their names and everything. Best smart glasses, Ray-Ban Meta 2, second gen, actually. The best home theater, Anker Nebula X1, which is a portable projector.
I would say that was a surprise for me. Usually home theater goes to like a sound bar or something like that. There haven't been that many really compelling ones this year, and the ones that we have reviewed were low to mid 80s. So this projector was, you know, hands down the highest rated product in the home theater category for the year.
How many people do you think own this?
That's a good question. It's a $3,000 portable projector, basically. It's not like an ultra short.
Like, it exists. Mm-hmm. It's neat. It may have been sent for review or, you know, purchased on it like as a business expense. But like, who in the real world owns this amazing projector?
People with a deck or a patio large enough to throw up a screen. And I will say, it's funny that you ask about that, because not long after we reviewed this, they announced an even bigger one. In early September, that's like a pedestal, like tall, all-in-one, speakers are built in, like crazy monstrosity.
Like a party speaker with a projector, it looks like.
Yeah, it's like a JBL, you know, party box with a projector in the top, basically.
This is a cool category. So Steve Dent reviewed this one for us, and I've looked at projectors quite a bit too. Projectors have always felt like the thing that consumers can't really think about because, you got to set up a screen or mount something. You have to mount this projector somewhere or find space for it. And with ultra short throws and these really portable ones, they've become a lot more flexible. So this thing is still $3,000, but it's also $3,000 and you may be able to find a way to make it work in your home. Like when I lived in freaking tiny Brooklyn apartment, I did manage to like get a projector screen that's on a tripod, and I unfolded it and we had movie nights. It was totally worth it for me because I'm a crazy movie fan. This thing is portable, You can also get speakers for it as well. So like Billy's saying, for backyard movie nights or something, just throw a bed sheet up. There's a lot of flexibility you have with a projector, both in terms of your home theater, but also anywhere. You bring this thing anywhere. My friend had a meeting, had a wedding once, and I brought my projector, and that's what we used to get their, you know, lovely relationship photos and stuff up. So they're really multifunctional. You just kind of have to, you're not, it's not just for your living room, right? But this thing is $3,000. This is not a regularly, readily accessible one. Anker makes a lot of projectors that are under $1,000 now. They're also would be really useful and really flexible. So anyway, that thing is cool. It's surprising. Best kitchen appliance, the Ninja Swirl by Creamy. The Ninja Creamy is a really fun thing. I know Sam Rutherford really liked that, and he reviewed the Ninja Swirl for us. The Swirl is just like the Creamy doing just soft serve, which is like niche of a niche. And I actually picked up a Creamy recently. It was refurbished. It was only $100, down from like $300. But like,
that's good.
It's cool because like you throw stuff in the containers, you freeze it overnight, and this machine will just grind it into ice cream or whatever. My kids love it. Like we're addicted, and we can make like healthier ice cream than normal. So I love the base, the typical Ninja Creamy. Sam really liked the Swirl. If you really want soft serve, I think this is, it's funny they had to make a whole other machine for this because the Creamy makes good ice cream and other like things too. It makes slushies. But that's cool.
I will say, you, Billy? You mm-hmm. mentioned earlier before we started recording that you thought that was a surprise. We did review a considerable amount of kitchen gadgets this year. And like the home theater category, this one was by and large, you know, much higher rated than a lot of the others. I personally reviewed some grills at the beginning of the year that, you know, weren't quite what we would consider best of the year. And there were other things along the way. But yeah, it was just a matter of, you know, Sam had the perspective from his previous experience with the brand. And yeah, he was just very impressed by it, like you said.
He was head over heels for it. I see.
And
also
I think
best...
that people mm-hmm. like Sam and Devendra are the perfect households for something like the Creamy because it is a single use thing. And otherwise you'd be like, why is this taking up so much space on my countertop?
Well, the Swirl specifically is single use.
But kids love ice cream.
Kids love ice cream. The Swirl specifically is single use. Like this is soft serve. The Creamy has like 11 different functions. So you can make... You can make soft serve, but you can also make like a smoothie. You could do like gelato mode. You could do like slushy mode. So I was like, I justified it to myself in that, oh, we can do all sorts of nice treats here without going to Dairy Queen.
Okay, yeah. So this is the sort of thing where if you wanted to elevate your, let's say, you know, the big tumbler shaker thing with like protein in it, you can just pour that into the Creamy and then like have it work some of its processing magic on it, make it a little thicker or something.
You can do whatever you want, whatever your heart desires. I literally, my first test for the Creamy was just like, I took some coconut milk and a bit of sugar and like vanilla extract. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to make a coconut, you know, basically coconut ice cream. And it was perfect. It was perfect and with far less sugar than the stuff that costs you $10 at the store. So
there's also something to be said for, I have like a Cuisinart where you freeze the bowl and it's got like a dasher in the middle and it just spins. And there's something to be said about pouring your mix in, walking away from it, and either listening for a chime or in my case, listening for it to start to struggle and you know it's ready. Because you know, I also have two kids and they are not patient, and I don't want something that I have to, you know, babysit or stir or whatever, you know, just pour it in, walk away, come back when it's done is very, very attractive.
That's I've cool. said set it and forget it like 5 times this week for whatever reason, but it's really true.
It's really true. The only thing about the Creamies is like you have to set it the day before. So I don't know about your thing, Billy, but like you definitely have to plan the night before. Like, okay, I want this type of ice cream the next day, and then the machine can make it, but it has to freeze for basically 24 hours. So that's the only thing. This is probably from you, right? The best kitchen accessory, the ThermoWorks RFX.
Yeah. So this one,
really? Okay.
oddly enough, was reviewed in January. They first started shipping at the tail end of last year, but we didn't get ours until after CES. So basically, if you're familiar with wireless food thermometers that are primarily used for grills, but you can use them, you know, baking, roasting, anywhere in the kitchen, it's a Bluetooth or Wi-Fi device that syncs with an app on your phone to relay temperature stats for primarily for meats, but you can do it when you're baking bread, you know, pretty much anything. But the way ThermoWorks has devised theirs is the sensors on the probe that you can see sort of in the pork shoulder there just monitors the internal temperature of the food. And then the secondary probe that's on the grill grates is for ambient grill temperature. And so the reason why they do that is there's a thing that happens when you're cooking large cuts of meat called evaporative cooling. And so the water that is coming and the temperature that's coming out of the meat is going to go by that temperature sensor that some companies put on the tail end of the food probe. So you get like a guesstimate, basically, for ambient grill temperature. It's not entirely accurate. And ThermoWorks was like, you know what? We're not going to mess with that, because the company's whole thing, if you've ever heard of like a thermopen or something like that, that, you know, chefs use in industrial kitchens for their accuracy. And so for the sake of maintaining that level of product design, they decided to just split it off to the sides to give you more accurate temperature readings for both your food and the grill. So yeah, it's a great product. It's highly accurate and reliable. And oddly enough,
very expensive, it looks like. But yeah.
Oddly enough, they came out with Wi-Fi compatibility first, which means if you're cooking something over several hours at a time, you can monitor it from anywhere on your phone. You know, so long as you've got a safe situation at home that you can leave a grill, somebody else is there or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's a great product.
I mean, I'm also thinking about this as like the perfect dad thing of like, you set up some ribs on the grill, you want to keep an eye on them. You've got a good enough Wi-Fi network that it covers the whole property. So you're out front mowing the lawn, and then you're like, okay, let me like, maybe you're even on one of those riding lawnmowers. Maybe it has a cup holder for a beer. And then you whip out your phone and you're like, oh, the cooking is going well, and you are just in the lap of suburban bliss for that 1 second.
You're just peak dad at this point. You know, I live in suburbia. I have not seen a riding mower. I have not seen people have big lawns here. It's kind of wild. King of the Hill lied to us, because Hank Hill had a very tiny lawn, but he had a riding mower. I don't know why. Best EV, the 2026 Nissan Leaf that I reviewed. I love this thing. I really wish I still had it. So I have a 2018 Nissan Leaf, which is their second gen. This is their first, the 2026 is the first third gen Leaf, which is more like, looks like a compact SUV, but it is a much better car. Like, none of the annoyances of the second gen. So whenever that upgrade can happen, this thing is $30,000 base for the base model. The one we reviewed was like 40-something thousand. It feels luxurious. It drives great. This is a great EV. So I'm thinking people are going to dig it if they can like withstand the shape and the color. People don't like unusual cars, I've noticed, but I'm a big fan. I like the turquoise color. I like the weird shape of this thing. 300 miles of range at a decent price. So check out my review of the 2026 Nissan Leaf if you're in the market for an EV. Also, don't buy new EVs. Another pro tip, lease them. If you want a brand new EV, maybe lease it, or wait a couple of years for that used market to hit, because those things drop in price like crazy, like wild. So anyway, check out that review.
Yeah, I was happy to see that that was the highest rated product in that category, because as you mentioned, it's accessible, and a lot of times,
so accessible,
you know, more often than not, EVs are still inaccessible for most people. And this one is definitely not.
Yeah. I mean, we had this conversation too. If you are in the market for an EV, consider a used EV. You can get one that's like 2020 model or above that still runs really well. The Hyundai Ioniq 5, all the like Kia EV6, I'm still looking at that Polestar and being like, I don't know how your price went down from $80,000 to $25,000, but that is an incredible deal. So used EVs, that's where the deals are at. Final category for us, best VPN is ProtonVPN, as reviewed by Sam Chapman. And I use ProtonVPN. I also use Proton Mail and all that stuff. They have a great suite of products. I really like this service. I use it for a whole bunch of things. Don't tell anybody, but sometimes it's helpful to see what's streaming in other countries and other territories. So Proton lets you move around. And also, even if you're just like browsing normally, it does the thing of like removing ad blockers, removes like a lot of the cruft that is on the typical internet browsing. So if you go to a site that loads badly normally, if you go through ProtonVPN, it will, given the technology they use, it usually cleans up that site totally. So anyway, that's a good one. Any final thoughts, Billy, like now that we've seen this entire list?
You know, we've talked about surprises and stuff, and I would say that the AirPods are a surprise to me, not because they're not good, just because I think there were overall fewer new premium sets of earbuds. I'm expecting to see a lot at CES, given how little there was over the last quarter of the year, last half of the year. And I also really kind of hate it when, you know, a product that's locked into one ecosystem is the highest rated or the best, you know, in our list or whatever. But the AirPods Pro 3 is a huge advancement on the AirPods Pro 2, even though the AirPods Pro 2 is going to get some of the features, some of the new features. But the upgrades to noise cancellation, especially, and how that applies to the other features like live translation, like hearing health, like there are a number of features where ANC is sort of like the baseline for those tools. And I actually interviewed a couple people from Apple right after the product launch about how they used ANC as sort of the basis for a lot of the new features. You can read it on Engadget.com.
Good features.
I would just say that it is kind of surprising that something that doesn't have more universal use case was not higher rated. But like I said, there weren't as many this year as there usually are. So,
yeah, that's fair. Every time I put on the AirPods Pro 3, I'm like, I'm constantly amazed because like if I'm working outside and somebody starts leaf blowing next door, I put these things on. It's magic. It is magic in a way that I don't typically experience with earbud ANC. If I do the Sony earbud, the Sony headphones, when I put them on, it covers my ears. Sure, you get like that level of ANC, but to have like just you snap your fingers and like the world is quiet from earbuds, it is crazy how good they are. So I've been on some flights recently. I sometimes have to work in noisy environments. It's wild. If you have an iPhone, if you're in the iOS ecosystem, this is such a huge leap. And then the sound quality itself also sounds better to me, Billy, and fuller, and the spatial audio sounds better. I don't know if you've noticed much of that.
Yeah, there is an upgrade in sound quality too, and a lot of that has to do with how they've angled the drivers. I know it sounds like, you know, the simplest thing ever, but having the angle of the drivers more directly into your ears has improved, you know, overall quality, clarity, detail, that sort of thing. And I feel like we also need to acknowledge that a significant chunk of the boost to ANC is the new foam infused tips that provide just a better passive noise isolation than the tips did previously. So they are doing, you know, their part for sure, but the overall, you know, computational audio that's happening for the ANC system is also improved in addition to the more robust noise isolation as well.
Yeah, definitely. I was coming from the AirPods Pro 2, and what I typically do is I buy the Comply foam tip. So I had foam on the Pro 2. So I had that difference. I had like, okay, I didn't think the leap, because I was already using foam-based tips, I didn't think the leap would be that much. It's just like the actual computational difference is wild when it comes to better ANC. So anyway,
and something that I wrote about last year with the Pro 2, which obviously still applies to the Pro 3, is using these as hearing protection, especially at like concerts or sporting events. Concerts especially, where you still care about the audio coming through being, you know, not foam earplugs to where it's like muted or not quite as good or whatever. These are excellent for concerts. And I've been using them probably for like 2 years now across the Pro 2 and Pro 3. And I, whenever I have to go back to like, you know, my loops or whatever, even though those are great products on their own and certainly more affordable just for concert use, you know, the AirPods do provide a superior experience in that regard as well.
That's cool.
I'd really like to try that out. Of course, being the audio guy, I'm like very precious about my earplugs and about my overall ear health. There's something in me that makes me still suspicious about just keeping AirPods in my ears.
Yeah.
Like, I know Apple is very likely to be one of the most trustworthy companies when it comes to that sort of thing. But Billy, if you think it's good, then maybe I'll have to try it.
Yeah, I will say it works with both ANC on and transparency mode on. Obviously, you get less
so protection. Do they turn the volume down if you use transparency mode?
The way that it works is, like, let's say you're in a 120 dB space. If you turn it on ANC, it might drop it down to 75, let's say, just as an example. That's not, you know, an exact number that I've observed or whatever. It may still be closer to 100 when you have transparency mode on. So the protection is not as robust if you opt for transparency mode over noise cancellation, but you still get some protection. You're not getting, you know, just completely blitzed by whatever is happening in the room. I will say the only issues that I've noticed are when I try to record videos at concerts with the AirPods on. There have been a few times where it has just not worked out, but at other times it's totally fine. So I don't know like exactly what's going on there, but you know, for the most part, if you're just using them as hearing protection, you do, Ben, as you mentioned, have to come to grips with the fact that you're wearing AirPods at a concert, which I've gotten a lot of weird looks. And even to this day, when people are wearing AirPods all the time, I still get weird looks at concerts. But I mean, you just have to accept the fact that like, it's better than foam earplugs for sure, I think. And yeah, you just got to accept it and own it. And just give them a thumbs up when they give you a weird look.
People still think it's weird to wear earplugs to concerts when I think like everyone is like, you should do that. If you go to concerts a lot, like just to protect your hearing because you don't get that back if you lose any of it. How are the loops for you, Billy? I have not tried those.
They look very cool. So I have both the loops and the Sennheiser earplugs. I believe I wrote about those last year. It may have been 2 years ago. So both of them have different settings. The loops in particular have three different settings, and it's easy to adjust. You just like rotate the dial, and you don't really have to hold them in place any kind of way, and you don't have to like push them into your ear painfully to adjust it. It's just on the outside of the loop. They work really well. The Sennheisers work really well too. They have, it's either three or four different filters that you have to manually change out. So you either have to decide ahead of time what you think you might need or be okay like in a crowd fiddling with the little tiny piece that goes in the middle. But I would say both of them are more comfortable than foam earplugs, and both of them offer a superior audio experience than traditional foam earplugs too. You just have to remember to take them with you. Otherwise, you're buying the foam ear tips from the bar. So
that's very cool. I would love to be able to go to concerts again, maybe someday. What else do we have to look forward to, Billy, when it comes to like our year end stuff? You mentioned a few things.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, we'll have a list of winners and losers of the year. So sort of how the companies performed, any companies that made any missteps over the year or sort of excelled in some regard or another. We usually compile that list by taking nominations among the staff. So that one will be a little bit more editorial than straightforward, like this best products of the year list was. And then we just, you know, sort of take suggestions from the staff on, you know, how they felt certain things went this year, mm-hmm. reflecting on major events or, you know, major crises or whatever.
It's a pretty calm year. Not much happened. So I think we'll be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there will probably be some regulatory government mm-hmm. administration reflection going on, maybe in terms of EVs, especially tax credits going away, companies not really being so hot on the US market anymore. We had a piece from Tim Stevens, Engadget alumni and also current contributor, go up yesterday about, it was an interview with an executive from Honda about how they have sort of cooled on the US market in terms of more affordable EVs coming from them and focusing instead on new hybrid technology. So, you know, there's stuff did happen. And, you know, as I'm sure you feel the same way, Devendra, mm-hmm. like a week feels like a month. And sometimes a week feels like a day when you're covering technology for a living. So stuff that happened in the first quarter of the year, we're going to have to go back yeah. and revisit. And so there's a lot of that going on as well.
Yeah. Typical year-end stuff. It is wild that we're thinking about this now, but it is November. So it's like we've got less than 2 months left. It all moves so quickly. Well, thank you so much for recapping this with us, Billy. Where can people find you online these days?
Primarily on Blue Sky these days. I don't post as much as I should probably, but, trying to get more regular posting about the audio coverage that we're doing and shouting out some of the, reviews, coverage from other editors on staff now that I'm sort of, coordinating those things. So yeah, primarily on Blue Sky these days.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much, Billy. Let's move on to some other news and leading story. Apparently, according to Reuters, Meta's earning a fortune on a deluge of fraudulent ads, according to documents. Meta projected 10% of its 2024 revenue would come from ads for scams and banned goods, according to documents seen by Reuters. The social media giant internally estimates that its platforms show users 15 billion scam ads a day. This is all quoted from Jeff Horowitz's report at Reuters. This sounds familiar for Meta.
Yeah, Jeff Horowitz
is also familiar, right? The guy
what
doing
else
that.
Did he
yeah.
report?
Did he do the Uber stuff as well, I believe? Yeah.
It was Frances Haugen. He yes. helped her blow the whistle. He also recently posted that thing about Meta allowing its AI chatbots to have spicy chats with minors.
That was a good piece.
Yeah, it was. I mean, mm-hmm. the phrasing of some of these things still sticks in my mind.
Yeah, I just want to say this. Yeah, this is not too surprising given everything we've seen from Meta. But
yeah,
go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, and I think that everybody should mm-hmm. go check out the piece on Reuters.com because it gives you a really good example of the sort of scam ads that are generating, let's say it again, 10% of Meta's ad revenue. That's nuts.
It's nuts. I mean, this is a company that also made bank early on with like crummy social media games. Remember Farmville? Has anybody thought about Farmville recently? I was covering technology and Facebook back when social media games were a big thing. Farmville was out there printing money, and a lot of those games were just pure garbage. Then Facebook was like, videos on our platforms. Video's going to make a ton of money. Everybody switch your entire video platform to use Facebook video. Turned out their metrics for counting that stuff was fake, so they forced a lot of media companies to basically fire people because they could not sustain their own video business. So
It's just the quality of the ads that is really striking to me. Like, if you look on the Reuters website, you know, you'll see some examples of like scammers trying to sell like McCormick spices or something. There's other stuff where it's like Elon Musk real package. It is an obviously photoshopped picture, or maybe AI generated picture, of Elon Musk holding up a piece of paper saying, basically, I want to give you money.
It says, hey, it's me. I have a gift for you. Text me. Done with a capital D.
Yes.
Period.
This is not necessarily anything that would actually, that like people would actually fall for, but I mean, they must be making a pretty good amount of money off of them anyway. Like, there must be click.
I mean, this is true for internet ads in general. I mean, a lot of sites, Engadget even had them at some point, but like, you look at those Taboola ads at the bottom of a site, which people keep around because it's just like, they do, they make some money, even though it's like linking to absolute like clickbait garbage or scammy stuff. Like, this is the internet we've built. And
Devinder, can you
okay
tell our listeners what this people would call the Taboola ads at the bottom?
I don't know. Like, hey, this secret for losing
weight. No. What the industry term for it is.
I don't even know specifically what you're thinking of right
I'm
now.
I'm leading you to the word chum box.
I've not.
Really? You haven't heard that before?
No. Well, it makes sense. I don't know when that term was created, but like, we've been railing against the Taboola ads forever.
So
that makes sense.
I think
Chumbox,
the really important thing about these scam ads is that many of them are offering money to just like average internet users. Hey, you happen to be on Facebook at the right time. It's basically outgrowth of the banner ads of like, congratulations, you're the 10,000th visitor of this website. But when you think about how hard up people are these days, like, one of the top searches, trending searches on Google, is very often like, when is next stimulus check? This is the sort of thing that really gets people excited. If you're sitting in your car on your break from a job that doesn't pay you enough money, maybe you'll click through. I don't know. It's just like sad and scary that Meta's doing this.
This is not chump change. This is, we were saying 10% of their annual revenue. That is $16 billion. That's a lot of revenue that they, the thing is, if they like worked to stop this, that's money, basically free money that they won't be getting if they actually stopped this problem. So for Meta, it's not really a problem. It's like a thing that, you know, it's an annoyance, but they don't really want to fix it. I guess we'll see what happens. But this is, scammy ads have always been a thing. Have always basically been a part of the internet, but it is wild. It's still such a major thing. I'm sure we'll see some updates to the story eventually. So stay tuned for that. Also saw the news. Congratulations, New York, for electing Zoran Mamdani as your new mayor. But we also saw the even more surprising news that he is making the right choices. Former FTC chair Lina Khan, who we've all fan gushed over for her role as the youngest FTC chair, somebody who actually pushed back against the monopoly tactics of Amazon and other big tech companies, she's going to co-chair Mamdani's transition team, which I'm sure makes all those billionaires that threatened to leave New York so happy. Who is it? Bill Ackman was kind of the big one. All those folks. I would love a camera pointed at them when they saw this news.
I think Ackman is also the one who then tweeted like, congratulations on your win, Zoran. Let me know if there's any way I can help.
After spending millions trying to stop him and then Cuomo as well.
You saw that clip from Flagrant, or it was Andrew Schultz's podcast where Zoran was like, oh, these guys are spending so much money against me. Habibi, I don't even want to tax you that much.
It's tremendous cell phones all around. But anyway, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, because Lina Khan, FTC, you know, as somebody working in regulation, was really focused on basically disempowering the sort of advantages that major, you know, big tech companies had and huge companies had. What does that mean for New York? We don't know. What does a less corrupt New York look like, Ben? I have no conception of that reality.
I'm really curious what possible role she could end up taking in the actual administration, though, because, I mean, her primary function is as an antitrust lawyer, and there is some stuff that you can do on the local level, and, like, you know, New York City government, big city, it's more powerful than your average local government, but still, like, there's not a lot that you can do without, like, state and federal cooperation, and you're definitely not going to get federal cooperation.
This is true, but also New York is not a normal city, right? New York has a bigger population than many states in America. New York has, like, yeah, a outsized economic impact. That's where the stock exchanges are. So
it would be really nice to have the cooperation of the Southern District of New York, but you're not going to get that because that's those are federal lawyers.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be really also camera on Bill de Blasio right now, just being like, oh, I remember when people had hope in me and I screwed that up. I hope Zoran does not screw this up. These are all very New York specific things, but also, like, hey, there is a wave of, like, Democratic wins across the country. Here in Georgia, we helped elect two Democratic public service commissioners, which is, it's kind of a wonky thing, but they were the folks who set the prices for power bills. And Georgia, power in Georgia is held by a monopoly, Georgia Power, which is owned by Southern Power, I believe. And they're like, they have been increasing prices a ton. They've been doing all sorts of stuff. We'll probably talk about this when it comes to just, like, power bills, because this is all, it's literally directly tech related and also related to energy technology and also the frickin' data centers for AI. They all play a role in all this. So this will probably be a future episode. But anyway, we're going to be keeping an eye on whatever Lina Khan is doing for Zoran Mamdani's transition team and also maybe what she'll be doing in the next administration. I will tell you, Ben, urge to move back to New York, rising.
Yeah, I've already seen a couple of edits of Lina Khan with laser eyes.
Let her loose, let her cook, I don't know. We also saw the release of the Motorola Edge, or the announcement, the Motorola Edge 70, another ridiculously thin smartphone that's less than 6 millimeters thick, putting it in league with the iPhone Air, according to Engadget's Lawrence Bonk. Okay. Super thin Android phone. I don't know. Are people even buying Motorola's anymore? Aside from the flips?
Maybe they're trying to, like, capitalize on people being interested again, but yeah, I really don't know. It's fallen really far from its heyday in the aughts.
For sure, for sure. And I think all these companies are just trying to, like, be like, can we achieve this? Can we make this engineering feat? And maybe somebody will want to buy a super thin Android phone. From what I believe we saw some numbers, like Samsung's super thin Galaxy that was released this year, I don't think it's been selling too well. So we'll see if people even care about this, especially this thing. It starts at £700, I believe, but that's about $900. So I don't even know if that's going to get, like, a major US release. We will keep an eye on that too. Ben, you want to talk about this? Netflix going big on video podcasts for 2026. They've teamed up with their licensing video podcast from Spotify Studios and The Ringer, because The Ringer is just everywhere. Shout out to those folks. How do you feel about this? Is this a betrayal of Spotify?
I think licensing The Ringer makes the most sense, because one of the huge gaps in Spotify's programming, or excuse me, not Spotify, one of the huge gaps in Netflix's programming is sports related stuff. And, like, they're trying to get some live sports, but even, like, sports talking, stuff that's kind of current, it makes sense that they would want that, because they're not just competing with HBO anymore. You know, there was that quote from years ago where they're trying to become HBO before HBO becomes Netflix, but now they're also trying to become YouTube. A lot of podcasts are on YouTube. They're trying to become ESPN. People will just put on SportsCenter because it's something that's, like, calming visual wallpaper for them. I don't know whether or not people are going to go to Netflix specifically for podcasts, though. Like, the genie is out of the bottle. The toothpaste is out of the tube when it comes to video podcasts. I just hope that they are done well. And I was talking with someone just earlier this week that said, oh, you know, in podcasts, because he owned a video podcast studio, he's like, audio doesn't matter all that much. Excuse me?
No!
Excuse me?
I hate it. I hate it. Yeah, let's just hang around in couches with shittier mics. Let's get headsets rather than even good mics that give you nice full audio. It is funny to see, like, essentially corporate interests ruin the idea of podcasting because they can only see content in one way.
Yeah. It's looping back around to become just like daytime TV or something.
I mean, Netflix just wants slop content, right? And podcast, like, The Ringer is producing good stuff. I know folks who work there doing some, like, movie-related commentary. Like, they're... People like watching commentary stuff. You know what we don't have as much anymore is special features on DVDs. So sure, if you give people access to, if you have this movie streaming or this TV series, and you can be like, hey, you can also watch this series about people talking about this show. Netflix and I believe HBO have done like their own like produced stuff around their shows, like the Stranger Things. I believe they have like a podcast that's available through Netflix. But you don't necessarily need, you don't need to make that stuff when there's so much of that content out there. It's easy enough to license it. And it doesn't really matter how good it looks to a certain extent. Like, people are mainly listening to these things in the background. I know podcast production, video podcast production has done better. We're trying. We're just a couple guys with like technology in a cave over here, literally, when it comes to streaming this stuff. But
yeah, the thing that I really don't like is when people feel like they need to build sets and stuff and, yes, you know, get a bunch, yes, of Blackmagic cameras, because that makes the entire prospect of making a podcast go from something where if you want to do it right, you might have had to spend like $500 or $600 in, 2020 or something. Now that video podcasts are a bigger deal, all of a sudden the budget has gone up to $10,000 because you want like three Blackmagic cameras and lights and maybe like a video interface on top of an audio interface. You still need the mics, but those are mostly window dressing now. It's just silly.
It's silly. I mean, I look at like the comedy podcast, like Amy Poehler has stuff. Like her show apparently is good, and I like the interviews she's done, but it is set up like a TV show, like a talk show. And that just, I don't know. I don't watch the other stuff too. Like, was it Call Your Daddy?
Yeah.
All those things. I don't know how much they lean into video. Also like just on a logistical level, once you add video, you can't just like be a schlub in your pajamas recording a podcast, which is what I love to do.
Which is precisely what the original like value proposition was. There were shows that punched above their weight in terms of getting guests because the, you know, high B-list celebrities that ended up on some of these audio-only shows at one time were like, this is amazing. I finally don't need to get camera ready for something.
It's, yeah, I think that's one reason Marc Maron was saying they never even touched video, right, with WTF.
Yeah,
Because they just weren't interested. It was just him and his co-creator, was it Brendan McDonald, and, like, they focused on the one thing. But I heard Conan, because... Conan, again, I'm such a big fan and I listen to his shows, but he complains like, I liked it before the cameras because I could just be sloppy. And even when you see the videos for their podcast now, he's not as well kept as he is, you know, for a video thing. Anyway, we will see. We will see what happens with the Netflix stuff. I briefly wanted to mention there's an update to the PS Portal, the PlayStation Portal, a device I did not like very much because it was very limited and it was $200. If you don't have a good router, it was only meant to stream games straight from your PlayStation 5. They have since, over the last few years, added more cloud connectivity, including games from PS Plus Premium. Now you can stream PS5 games that you own over the cloud to the PlayStation Portal, which is something you could have done before. You could have connected to your PlayStation 5 and have that PlayStation 5 stream a game over the cloud. So you're like two hops over the cloud to get something to the portal. Now you could just do it straight from the portal. That's more useful, I think. I will be re-reviewing the PlayStation Portal soon to see like where it stands today. I hated this thing when it launched, but it has become much more useful. So we will see. I'm looking forward to like looking back at this thing and giving me an excuse to play some Ghosts of Yote as well, because I have not been able to do that. There's just too much stuff going on. So if you have a PlayStation Portal, this may be useful for you. Ben, I feel like you were excited about this.
Yes.
The Teenage Engineering Rhythm.
Yes. It's another, like, kind of reskin of their EP-133 KO sampler. And this is like this KO sampler is like a really popular form factor for them. It looks like a big calculator. It's got a bunch of nice pads that you can like finger drum beats out on. This same form factor is also found in the EP-1320 Medieval sampler that you might have heard about if you're deep into music technology like I am. This is something that only had, I'm talking about the EP-1320, only had sounds that you might find in like a medieval movie, like the sound of a bowstring being drawn and maybe an arrow flying by your ear and like a blacksmith hammer hitting an anvil. Like, it was a really silly thing that, of course, because it's Teenage Engineering, you're going to spend like more than $300 on. I think this rhythm sampler is going to be a lot more fun. It's definitely going to have like a lot of the really spacey echo stuff. And really the reason that I put this on the list for other news today is because I think it's very funny that this is a Swedish company making a reggae sampler. And rhythm itself was partially inspired by this Japanese woman, Okuda Hiroko, who was like an ethnomusicology major in school, got a job at Casio, and then made this rock preset for the Casio Tone MT40. And that ended up in Jamaica. All of the reggae producers were like, this is amazing. And that's how Slang Tang Rhythm was born. Like, it's crazy, it's global, and thank you, Sweden, for getting in on the globalization of music here.
I love music nerds, also especially Japanese music nerds, because like Yoko Kanno, the composer of Cowboy Bebop, is a similar thing. She just like spent, I think, a year or so, or like a summer traveling the US and visiting jazz club, and she's like, I can do a tribute to this, and produces the Cowboy Bebop soundtrack, which is incredible.
Yeah, an
incredible homage to American jazz.
I would call that beginner's luck, but yeah, that's just because I'm mad.
No, she's just a genius. Like, she is a straight-up genius. So shout out to Yoko Kanno and all of her soundtracks. Sometimes I listen to her, certainly the Cowboy Bebop, but the Macross Plus soundtrack, I listen to that just to feel things sometimes. She is incredible. So anyway, thank you for talking about this, Ben. We're going to move on to stuff happening around Engadget. We've got a post from Steve Dent about why DJI drones might be banned in the U.S., This is going to be an ongoing thing, similar to what happened with Huawei, I think. And
this is also something that we've talked about like a lot months ago. We were talking about this with Sherlyn.
It's let me read the story here. Since being placed on a Department of Commerce entity list in 2020 over national security fears, China's DJI has faced the threat of a U.S. ban on its hyper-popular drones. After exhausting its appeals and losing a lawsuit last month, DJI products like the Mini 4 Pro, Avata 2, and Neo may disappear from U.S. shelves starting December 23rd. The situation could be even worse than initially expected. So go check out this piece. Steve Dent covers drones for us, covers cameras, and he has reviewed a lot of DJI gear. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with this. I've also seen, was it somebody at The Verge or somebody noticed that like DJI was also shipping some of their gadgets over here under a completely different brand name.
Oh, that's interesting.
So somebody found, I think the Osmo wonderful, like, gimbal camera that we like, literally the exact same product, boots the same way, has the same software. On the box has a different brand, completely different branding. So I wonder if that's going to be a thing DJI could do. You still got to get those products over from China. That's the big problem. That's where the tariffs and the sales bans come in. So we will see what happens there. Also wanted to point to a couple pieces from Tim Stevens, former Engadget person, actually former Engadget editor-in-chief. He was over in Japan testing out some of Honda's new EV and hybrid technology. He saw three new EVs that most likely will not make it to the U.S., including a really, really cute tiny one. And also Honda's new hybrid technology, which seems like it has some like fake gear shifting capabilities, which could be cool for people who want to do, like, I don't know, fun driving. You want to downshift, you want to upshift, you want to like feel like you have more control of your car. That could be a really cool thing. Check out those stories from Tim Stevens. Anything that you're working on, Ben, you want to shout out? You're at a conference right now. What are you doing?
I'm working on networking, but also kind of commiserating because these people assembled here in Richmond are almost 100% like documentary style, long form storytelling sort of stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And now we're feeling like we're on the outs. So that's what I'm working on. I'm working on community building.
Or community surviving. Okay. Well, thank you, Ben. Good luck at that conference, and I hope you find your cable. I'm working on a review of Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. I think I talked about that when I did get to see it. Was it a couple of weeks ago? It's a very good adaptation. Guillermo del Toro was basically born to make this thing because he is essentially adapted. He has brought Frankenstein themes into almost everything that he's made, including Blade 2. The masterpiece that is Blade 2. So it is really cool to see him finally get a chance to make Frankenstein. I also reviewed the new M5 Vision Pro that went up this week. It's still a beta test. It's still not a thing for regular consumers, but I did kind of lay out like where it could be headed and what I'd like to see Apple do. I'm definitely spending more time with the X-Reel One Pro these days, and I would really love to see like some of that form factor and some of that tech make it over to the Vision Pro or the Vision OS ecosystem. Any pop culture picks for us this week, Ben?
Fall music. Just all kinds of fall music. And for me, that means basically like emo, twinkly guitar. Like, I've been listening to a lot of Tidal Fight. I've been listening to a lot of Pine Grove. I just started listening to the album 22 A Million by Bon Iver. And that was released in 2016. That's almost 10 years old. But it's the big one where he moves from just like Man in the Woods with an acoustic guitar sort of sound to, guess what, I'm using vocal samplers and vocoders and all sorts of crazy electronic stuff. It's a good time for wistful walks, looking around at the changing of the leaves. That's what I'm doing.
Awesome. Awesome. Have you, speaking of music stuff, that Rosalia song has been going everywhere. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Incredible. Bergen.
I've seen some people talking about what other people have said about it, of like, oh wow, you know, it's so much more evolved. It's so, like, people are saying that there's you know, some bias against like the like kind of trap reggaeton sort of sound that she was doing, and now they're saying, oh, it's so much more evolved and mature because she's going back to her classical. Like, it doesn't matter, it's good music.
Yeah,
like, she wouldn't have gotten into the business if she wasn't a overall good musician, so just appreciate all of it.
She's classically trained. Yeah, but it's also like doing I loved her last album, but she also got a ton of flack for that too, because she's essentially taking Latin American style music, right?
True.
She is
She's a Spanish
performer.
Like, so it's like capital S Spanish.
It is. Yeah. There is like a colonizer, you know, feeling around that, especially when she was like straight up, you know, doing reggaeton. But also that album was incredible. So I feel like she is at least talented enough to do good stuff here. This one, it's certainly, I love that she teamed up with Bjork. This is the lead track, which you can see the video all over. It's popped up all over TikTok and YouTube, but it is a really well-produced video of her singing like a gorgeous German opera song. And then Bjork comes in, and then Yves Tumor comes in, and it's like this wonderful mixture of just like modern meets classical. It's incredible. Like, it's an incredible thing. I love that this song is everywhere, and it kind of captures the moment in a way. So I'm looking forward to Rosalia's new album, Lux, coming on November 7th. So there's that. I also want to shout out Dispatch, the game from Ad Hoc Studio, which is a studio by former Telltale folks. So Telltale makes games like, you know, The Walking Dead and The Wolf Among Us. These are narrative games with not too much gameplay, but the key is like they had really strong writing. They had like multiple choices. They had the ability for you to like craft the story.
Let's be real. They're choose your own adventure books.
they're choose your own adventure, but they're really, really well done and done in a way. I've always loved choose your own adventure books. Like I grew up reading those. I'm flipping back and forth. So that's part of my origin story. But also Telltale like did a good job of taking that formula, but also adding in really, really great writing, great performances, striking art design for pretty much all of their stuff. I even like the freaking Borderlands game they did, and I don't even care about Borderlands, but Telltale did a Borderlands story and it was really great and affecting and well directed and well written. So anyway, Dispatch is from some of those folks. It is about a former superhero who works on like a dispatch call center sending out other superheroes. He's like grounded, so the actual gameplay of this is often you're looking at a map of a city. Emergency happens here. Your job is to like pick, you select that emergency, pick who you're sending there. And it's a wide group of people with different powers. One is like a
wolf. You have to worry about like the compatibility of the heroes that you're sending out to, right?
That's the whole point.
Yep.
This is a story. This is a narrative. So yeah, your job is to send out these actually former villains who are now in like a superhero rehabilitation program to become heroes and not just be like criminals. So it's a bit of a Suicide Squad thing too. So you have the unruly kids. Your job is to try to basically manage them and align them and pick the right person for the task. But maybe some people don't want to work together. Maybe somebody's fighting with you and they don't want to listen to you. That's the meat of the gameplay. But the actual game is a really well done story of somebody who used to pilot an Iron Man style suit. Major event happens. He cannot do that anymore. And he is trying to rediscover who he is, deal with his own legacy and the idea of being a superhero and how to, it's honestly a lot about middle management. It's about like, how do you make other people kind of be good enough to achieve some of the dreams you used to have when you physically or professionally cannot do that anymore? So there's a lot going on here.
Only weird thing about this game, though, is that it's a strange mix of professional actors and YouTubers. So you've got like the lead character played by Aaron Paul. You've got like another big character played by Jeffrey Wright. Amazing. Yeah. But then you also have like, I think Jacksepticeye or like a few other YouTubers, and then also the white rapper Young Gravy. Like, okay, sure.
Alana Pierce is in here too, who's used to work at IGN and other things. It's really good stuff. Like the writing is really well done. There's some great, the relationships are good. What Telltale was always good at was building characters you cared about and you cared about the relationship dynamics. And I've noticed this like for any story, for TV shows, whatever, the relationships, the characters sell it more than the plot typically. And that is kind of where we're at with Dispatch. So I think we're, how many episodes in are we now? We are six episodes in right now. Episodes 5 and 6 were just released. I played those last night. I didn't realize it was 2.
What's the average gameplay on each episode?
Maybe about an hour.
Okay.
Like 30 minutes to an hour, depending on like how long you spend agonizing over certain decisions. But it's cool. Like it's just you as a manager guy trying to like get this team together, trying to make them work better and try to see the best in themselves. And also, it is a world where people understand superheroes exist. They're commonplace. And this company you're working for, you clock in and you kind of manage them like you do, like you're managing a crew of people going out to, you know, do street cleaning or something. It's a really interesting setup they have here. So it's very much like the world of Invincible, except you're playing it and people understand superheroes are a thing and super like villains are a thing and giant monsters may appear in the world. It isn't one of those things, except you are just a middle manager. It's really cool. It's really well done. Great writing. Aaron Paul is fantastic. Check it out. It is currently only on PC and PlayStation 5. But this is such like a low graphics game. This will head to Switch eventually. This will head to other platforms. It's really, really good. Check it out. I've played all the episodes available so far in about 3 days. So I am hooked on this thing.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Blue Sky, and also podcasts about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Send me your wistful fall playlists at Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.